Welcome to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z, covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. John, we just had an amazing conversation with human rights activist Melanie Nathan.
Yes, I've heard her on your show a couple times, and I've interviewed her with you, but this was the first time I got to see her in person and have an hour-long conversation with her. That was great.
Yeah, I mean, the story of her being shut down, I guess, you know, or denied or turned away or however you want to describe it, all those things,
right,
from the Navy, in which she was scheduled to speak during LGBTQ month. It was so important to start talking about these things. I think that, you know, her own experience of that and then also fighting back, that can give us so much inspiration to also not feel like we can't talk about these issues.
Right. And when people hear her, they'll immediately recognize by her voice and her accent, she was not born in the United States. She was born in apartheid South Africa. And she learned the lessons there of not being able to talk about things and of, you know, people who watch what they say and such. And you know Melanie far more than I do. You know, she's not the type of person who ever is going to keep her tongue on stuff.
No. I mean, stretching all the way back, you know, when we were fighting for marriage equality and her being a part or a support system and representing Shirley Tan, the case of Shirley Tan, and to now this point, I mean, all she wanted to do was to be able to contribute and speak as an LGBTQI person to the Navy during LGBTQI month and, you know, and putting together this educational presentation, but because of some tweets to the president, they actually then told her that they were not going to, you know, ask her to speak. And so I think this interview is very, very, very important. We can't wait for you to hear it.
Yeah. And hey, it's actually been a couple of weeks since we've had you here. You've been recovering from SF Pride?
I'm still in recovery mode. It was great. It was awesome and a great turnout. This was the first year that we had our CBS broadcast partnership. And So there was a 6-hour live stream of the parade, you know, which the parade kicked off with the resistance contingent. It was amazing to see all those signs of protest and that protest element of the parade come back, as well as Dykes on Bikes. It was a very emotional year. One of our grand marshals was a Dykes on Bike member had passed away before being able to be a part of the parade. So lots of great things, not just the parade, but also the celebration site, the entertainers, the speakers on main stage. We actually had folks come out and speak out against the family separation or the zero tolerance policy that instructed by the president and his administration. And I just felt like, you know, it was all of those things, a celebration, a protest, a coming together of the community, coming together of our allies, LGBTQ people. And then the last 2 weeks, I just need to sleep.
Well, we're glad you woke up.
Yeah,
we're glad you're back here at the Commonwealth Club, and we're going to have you here again next week. Let's talk a bit about our special program on Tuesday. We've got
Katie Sowers, who is, I think, officially the first lesbian NFL coach as out lesbian NFL coach,
and she's only the second female NFL coach.
Wow. 2018, we're, you know, it's groundbreaking and we're doing so much. But I'm so excited to speak to her. I think that she's been vocal about her journey and also very vocal about her support system. And I think those inspirational stories, when we share them with the community, those are the types of stories that remind us of the values of our, you know, why we're here, why we wake up every day, why we do what we do, why it's important to be out and to be supportive of the LGBTQ community.
Exactly, and to be out and because she could have gotten her job and stayed, you know, not let people know, and she didn't. And it's good to see a team.
Yeah.
Actually, this is her second team who has employed her.
The 49ers have been very vocal about, you know, they hired Katie because she's a good coach.
Yeah.
And that's very important to note as well, that people don't say, oh, because she's the first female and out lesbian coach. No, Katie Sowers is an amazing coach, and she's going to be with us. We're super lucky.
Yeah, we're going to schedule out all of the plays for the next three games. She's going to give us what, you know, quarterback roles. I obviously have no idea what they use in football.
I was going to say, you are an awesome gay sports broadcaster. It's football, not soccer, right? I'm worse. I'm joking. Yes, we're very excited. So July 17th, come on out.
We'll let her do all the football talking. We'll just nod and look like we understand. Well, of course, Tuesday's program with Katie Sowers is a special program we're doing here. Certainly come and join us if you can. But we're here every Thursday at noon, and we'd love to have you come out, meet our guests, and meet Michelle, get your photo taken with her, which is one of the most popular things people do here, but also to ask your questions. So we'd love to see you.
That's right. Well, let's get started with the program. Here's our special guest, Melanie Nathan. Welcome to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z, covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. I'm Michelle Meow, and here on Thursdays at the Commonwealth Club, we tape the show for Progressive Voices with my co-host, John Zipper. John, very, very excited and happy to see you.
Good to see you again, Michelle, and I'm very happy about our guest today.
Yeah, we have an exciting show. Our guest today has been on the show several times, actually, and is an activist, once a human rights attorney, is a wonderful mother, is a wonderful community member, as well as a writer, author. I mean, the list goes on, but we have had her on the show to talk about human rights, especially asylum refugee issues. She's the executive director of the African Human Rights Coalition and a good friend. Melanie Nathan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Michelle. It's lovely to be here. Nice to see you, John. Thank you for having me.
So we usually, you know, come to you, especially in the past when there had been anti-LGBTQ propaganda from the folks of like Scott Lively of Gonda, Uganda to, you know, do those types of things. And we've had you on for, of course, the immigration policies that have changed, really, and how that's impacted the LGBTQ asylum and refugee situation. But today we're here to talk about discrimination that has affected you personally. And I'm calling it discrimination. But we'll get into it. You were denied an opportunity to speak during Pride Month, and it's by this interesting division, actually. It's the Nave Air, or the Warfare Weapons Central Division, which sounds really scary, but also shocking that they have an LGBTQ program. Where do we start?
Yeah, this is interesting. This was more than just being denied an opportunity. This was a binding agreement for me to speak. So let me give you some history. NAVAIR has bases all around America, and there are two bases in Southern California that I know of, China Lake and Point Magoo, and there's a weapons division, and it's largely the employment situation there. There are a lot of civilians, mostly civilians, and they have a diversity group. And it was the diversity group that approached me and asked me, we had some discussions, and they said, look, we have a Pride Month celebration coming up. Would you like to speak? And if so, go ahead and give us a proposal. And that's what I did. I made a proposal. I set out what I wanted to talk about, and I put a fee attached to that. They came back to me and they said, well, you know, we know you're a global activist, but this is a little not America-centric enough. So could you adjust and have a more American relatable type program? And I said, absolutely. And it was them who came up with a suggestion that we look at the pride themes from different cities. And that included the San Francisco Pride theme, which was Generations of Strength, which we all know our community member Larry had suggested, and San Francisco Pride wonderfully and beautifully accepted and executed this past Pride Month. And so not only did I take Generations of Strength, but I put what my speech would be about. I divided it into categories like a little curriculum. Submitted that back to them. They loved it. And they said, we accept your proposal. We accept your fee. We can't pay you in advance. You can invoice us afterwards. So we got rid of the nitty-gritty. And so we had a binding legal agreement. And it was about a couple to a few weeks before I was going to speak that I was asked, oh, would you like to come with us to lunch in between the two venues? And I said, yes, I would love to do that. Then I got an email giving me the badge security forms to fill out for my badges. So I'm telling you that detail because that's how far we got. And so it's much more than just being denied the opportunity. I was just completely shut down with an email that I got basically telling me that they had seen my critical tweets to Donald Trump and about Donald Trump, and for that reason, basically to cease discussions was the term they used, which is a little disingenuous because it was not even acknowledging that we had that much of a legal agreement between us.
Now, had they, you said they were going back and forth with you on, you know, reframing what you were going to talk about. Did they ever say, for example, you can't say anything political or you can't criticize the president?
So, yes, that did come up in our discussion, and they were very clear with me. They said, this is going to be purely educational. You have to present a presentation that is going to be purely educational. And so I totally agreed to that in advance. I said, I will not be political. It's about history. I'm going to relay the history of the LGBT movement and on very many different levels. And I'd laid out exactly what I was going to talk about. And I had sent them a PowerPoint presentation in advance. And I said, I'm only going to use pictures in my PowerPoint presentation. The rest will be verbal. And they said to me, the only prerequisite is if you change anything in your PowerPoint presentation, that a week to 2 weeks before you let our legal department look at it and to approve it. So, and in an email that I got from them when my proposal was accepted, they had sent it to their legal department. So legal had approved my talk and my PowerPoint.
It's just interesting to me because how can you ask LGBTQ speakers to not be political? I mean, our lives are political, and especially our history. And when you talk about generations of strength, you're looking at many activists who have done, who have just been as outspoken as you have. So I'm curious to know, I mean, were any specific tweets pointed out?
No, they didn't point out specific tweets. But you're right. How can such a conversation not be political? Well, you can make it not political by simply stating the facts and not necessarily attaching any kind of critical dialogue that says the Republicans did this or the Democrats did that. I mean, you certainly could say under the George W. Bush administration, you know, DOMA was implemented or, you know, or back to Clinton or whatever, and that, you know, George W. Bush made a point of, and Donald Trump has, you know, you could say that because you're referring to administrations and laws that didn't happen. Right. You could say President Obama signed the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. So, yeah, there are elements of political in the history. When it came to the tweeting in and of itself, they didn't point out political tweets, but I will take full 100% responsibility for being super critical about Donald J. Trump. And this is the interesting thing, is that my criticism of Trump goes back to the first day he opened his mouth, where he scapegoated people from Mexico by in my the way I interpreted what he said, saying basically, well, if you're a Mexican immigrant, then you're a rapist and a murderer. And from that moment on, I immediately, and I know people hate this comparison, but I immediately saw a trajectory starting, and I've been proven correct. And I immediately started making analogies to when you scapegoat people, where that can lead. So right in the beginning, I saw Donald J. Trump as an extreme danger, and it's proved to be correct. When they had that first Super Tuesday, about six of us, nobody was really protesting him at that point. It was right in the beginning. About six of us got together and decided to hold a little demonstration outside the building that he co-owns here in the city. And we made a big splash to the press. We said, we put out a big press release, and we were a group called Gays Without Borders. And there we showed up, about three or four of us with our signs, and there were TV cameras, the press was there, nobody else showed up, and 18 police officers showed up on motorcycles. And so they were anticipating a lot more than it was. But look at where we've come since then in terms of our marches and stuff. Why I'm bringing it back to that point is because that's when I was outspoken, right all that time ago. So for people who hire me to speak, to not know what I've been saying, it's very... I can't understand why at this late stage they suddenly dinging me on that basis.
Do you have any sense of what happened in there? I mean, who made the call not to or to disinvite you or whatever?
So I don't know who, what, how, where, or when, but I'm going to speculate. And from perhaps a little bit of chitter-chatter that I've heard, I think that maybe a couple to a few people suddenly realized that I had been that critical and sometimes flamingly critical. And I think that those people went to whoever was in charge of that diversity event and said, we really can't have the speaker because she is saying the stuff against our commander-in-chief. And you know, the way this letter was worded to me, we recently became aware of several comments you've made on Twitter regarding our nation's current administration. While those comments and views are not inappropriate for an individual given free speech, they are inappropriate to our agency to endorse in a potential speaker of a command-sponsored event. Given our position within the Department of Defense, the president serves as our commander in chief. Therefore, we need to cease further discussions with you. From the way it seems to have come down, I think that it denotes a culture of fear. It denotes the divisiveness, maybe even within the civilian ranks, maybe even within the military ranks. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because today I see that Peter, and I can't say his last name, the FBI guy who's being interviewed today in Congress. It's interesting. He had these personal, non-public conversations with a partner of his, and he's been raked over the coals for his personal views. And I heard him on television this morning so eloquently explained how that does not interfere with FBI procedures. You know, so he's separating his personal perspective from his work perspective. And I see a parallel there on some level, that why are we not entitled to be personal with people we love? Why can't I send my daughter or a partner a tweet and say, you know, this? But for me, I went public.
Well, you know, this obviously proves the many articles that we are starting to see and populate and shared that certain departments of this administration is absolutely checking your social media. I mean, I guess, you know, employers do it. They ask for your Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff. But for this purpose, I mean, you're right. You presented an educational presentation, and then your social media handle was taken into consideration for things that you're talking about and saying as an individual and not necessarily as the presenter. I mean, my question, you know, to you is that even the way the email was framed, it was very conflicted, and it almost as if that person didn't really think about what implications could follow. You're not one, and I know you personally, to ever, you know, walk away when you feel you were wronged. So in this situation, you did not walk away. You got that email, and immediately, how did you respond?
Oh, that's a really good question, because it's so interesting that you say that, Michelle, because you're right. I'm the kind of person who speaks out, but all my life I've been used to speaking out for other people as a lawyer, as an activist, as an advocate. I've always spoken out for someone else. And I've also always spoken out as being a member of a community. So when I hear anti-Semitism, I'm quick to speak out as a Jew. If I hear anti-LGBT or homophobia, I'm quick to speak out as an open lesbian. And when I'm advocating for a particular individual or an organization, I will speak out for that. I have never been in this situation before where I've been personally you know, in this situation. And my initial response was to actually consider others. My initial response was less about myself. And immediately I thought, I can't be quiet about this, but I don't want to implicate the people that made the introduction. And I was looking at what the collateral damage would be if I did speak out. And I did seek counsel from friends and mentors, and I got conflicting perspectives. And eventually I tapped into me. I tapped into who I am, what this means to me. How would I live with myself ultimately for not speaking out? How would I not set the right example to my two daughters? To speak out. We're talking about the Me Too movement right now. We're talking about speaking out. This has even been a journey for me and a lesson to me that not speaking out makes me hypocritical. Because when I tell people stories or when I advocate for them, I expect them to speak, and I always speak to their courage, you know? And how could I not? You know, this is not a bone spur moment.
In speaking out, you actually went the legal route. You got together with an attorney yourself, but you brought in an attorney. Tell us about that and what type of response then that took, what form.
Yeah. So I contacted Lisa Bloom from the Bloom Firm in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. who I know is an ally and a well-respected civil rights attorney. And her response was so validating and so extraordinary, and she just jumped right to my defense and said, I'm willing to help you with this. And so, again, foreign to me and how I've had to deal with my life in the past, I became completely, in agreement that this is how I should pursue it. And so Lisa has taken on my case and has written to NAVAIR on my behalf, mm-hmm. and has appeared with me on other media to speak out about it, has provided extraordinary guidance, and she's been a wonderful support. And so right now we're in the process of a negotiation, which has just basically recently come out, which we can speak to. She will be the one to speak to later on in terms of where we go with that.
What's interesting is I find it to be, you know, almost like a silencing or an infringement on a constitutional right. I mean, I get that, yes, we're able, or, you know, they're contracting you. They're basically employing you to come to speak. But we haven't really talked about that. I mean, am I wrong here? I mean, this whole idea of freedom of speech has been used to cover up even hate speech. That's my opinion, and I'm throwing that out there. But even in the media, and is used by persons of the administration. I mean,
you know, it's interesting. Coming to America for me, being an immigrant from a country like South Africa, I came here during the apartheid era. So I came here during a time of oppression. Now, I was a white privileged South African. I didn't feel the oppression in the way that other people in that country felt it. But I certainly had elements of oppression come down on me because my freedom of speech was curbed. I couldn't speak out against the apartheid government. When I came to America, getting to learn and understand and live that First Amendment, that constitutional right that I have as an American, was an exercise for me. I had to learn how to do that. And I think a lot of immigrants coming from oppressive countries have to learn how to live the First Amendment. And I was shocked in America that when the Westboro Baptist Church would show up at the funerals of gay soldiers and they would have these hateful signs, and I would go to events where we were protesting for marriage equality, and I would see signs calling me words that I don't even want to say on the air. And for me to understand that they actually had a right to do that was always hard for me to comprehend, because I never thought that the First Amendment right could apply so widely. Until I met a man who lost his son, his gay son, Jeff Wolfhart, lost his son, Andrew Wolfhart, a gay man in Afghanistan. And it was Jeff Wolfhart who said to me that when Westboro Baptist Church showed up at his son's funeral and the court upheld their right to do that, he agreed with it because, and he pulled out Andrew, his late son's constitution that Andrew carried in his pocket on the field in Afghanistan and the day he died. And he said, that's what my son fought for. And so I've come to understand that who and how do we interpret hate? And actually, as an aside, which I find really interesting, right now in South Africa, the Nelson Mandela Foundation is asking that the old apartheid era flag that was being flown, which is now showing up gratuitously being flown at different things. And it's not an official flag. There's a new flag since the new South Africa, since Nelson Mandela became president. But this old flag is showing up and being flown gratuitously. And the Nelson Mandela Foundation's come out and said, we want to ban that flag because it is hate speech. And the organization is really interesting. The organization that's promoting the being able to fly that old flag has said, well, what about the rainbow flag? They said, "How? If you ban that, then you've got to ban this and you've got to ban it." And I actually just did an amicus brief affidavit showing the difference between the rainbow flag and the old apartheid era flag, and how can you even compare the two? Because one is a flag of love, diversity, peace, inclusion, and the other is a flag that really belongs as a relic in a museum where you can go and look at it and learn the history of it. But when you fly that gratuitously, in my opinion, that is hate speech. So I'm kind of conflicted coming from that country, even in and of myself. Being the American within the realm of America, you have every right to say anything and everything, fly anything and everything. But coming out of that South African context and seeing what it means to a majority of people that were so horribly oppressed by that flag, I do have understand how it can go in that direction.
But I mean, does that impact you now with your tweets? And are you thinking about pulling back maybe on some of the harsher side of your criticism of the president? I mean, you know, before we started the show, you talked about normalizing the president and this not, many people in the community don't want to normalize this president who has become divisive, you know, and even I'm stumbling here because honestly, when you called me about what was happening, you said, you can't tell anybody this is happening to me. I heard like your cell phone kind of clicked out, and then I was like, I feel like somebody's listening to me. And from that point forward, I really started checking my own social media posts and have been really careful, even checked my wife, Orwan, who's, you know, we're in the documentation process, and I'm like, just make sure you don't say anything, and everything's in tie, so I think we're okay. But it really did affect me. Mm. So when I'm talking about, like, freedom of speech, I mean, do you feel like there's a part of us that we're going to start silencing ourselves because of fear, because of something like this that could happen to us and affect our professional life, affect our families?
Yeah. You know, I feel almost like I was born with some kind of proclivity to be an activist. It's almost like when you go to the gas station and you can choose between diesel and number 76. Well, there's one that says activist, you know, and you press that activist button and you put that thing in your gas tank, except what happens when you put the activist gas in the gas tank, it's a Tesla out of control. You know what I mean? It's like the car goes and you're not at the wheel. Sometimes I feel like that. Sometimes I feel like there's a part of me that's so fiery and so strong believing in justice that I'm no longer in control of that steering wheel. So from my kind of nature and the kind of person I am, it spurs me on. I have less fear. It makes me want to fight more. It makes me want to go into the street. It makes me want to boycott. I get so fired up and so angry. But I do understand those people who, and I'm a risk taker. I'll jump into the deep end and take a risk. I'm not afraid, but there are those, I'm not afraid of it. It won't silence me. But I do understand those people who don't have that number 2000 and whatever gas in their tank. And those people, and I don't judge it. I just think we're different people, we're different types of people, and we do things differently. And but I will tell you where it has made me conscious. You know, the last First Lady, Michelle Obama, said, "We take the high road, we don't take the low road." I realized I took a lot of low road in my tweets. I got extremely ad hominem. I did some name calling.
You called him a moron.
I called him a moron. I'm probably an imbecile, and you name it, I called him it. And it has made me a little bit more conscious of that on two levels. Either I'm a little bit not so sure that I want to be that ad hominem anymore, but I realized that it was just tapping into my anger, and that it was just, I was doing what he was doing. It was this impulsive instant relief that I was just firing back. So there is that element where I don't know if I'm going to rein myself in or not, and I have a little bit since then in terms of the ad hominem, but not in terms of what I want to say about the issues.
Sorry to interrupt, but kind of right in there then. Do you think they rescinded or ceased discussions, if you will, or rescinded the invitation, basically, because of the language you used or the fact that you attacked the president directly on certain things?
That's a really good question, and I'd have to ask them the answer to that. However, the minute he went on there with his crooked this and his little that and his big this and I'm this and you that and his ad hominem stuff, you know, the gloves were off. So you can't establish a paradigm and not agree to perform, you know, to be subject to it as well. So I don't believe that would be a valid argument necessarily in this particular context to distinguish between the two. You know, and then again, even in his own White House, he's got people calling him a moron. And they haven't come out to deny that. And it's been said on national TV.
Yes, his own cabinet members.
My tweets are not out of left field. I could understand it more if it was out of left field. You know, if I said what I'm saying now to someone like Reagan, it, you know, as much of his stuff I didn't agree with, it would be different. But this is the different era and the culture, and the playing field is just so different right now.
Go ahead, John.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, do you think he kind of drags other people down in that level? And so they find themselves kind of getting muddy in the fight with him, and he thrives on that.
Yep. I have to admit that you're absolutely right, that there is that element of that. And so that's, as I say, that's where I'm sort of reconsidering myself and regrouping. But here's the thing. It's like when you're tweeting him, and I tweeted at Real Donald Trump, that's his Twitter account, I got blocked by him in January. I entered into this agreement in March, I think it was. May, the beginning of May. I think it was the end of April, beginning of May. So I'd already been blocked by at Real Donald Trump. Doesn't mean I can't Twitter to at POTUS, which I do. But I'll tell you the tweet. I got blocked because it went viral. And it was when the government had shut down. Remember, Congress had not been able to reach that budget. And Donald Trump himself was tweeting out, the military is closed and it's all the Democrats' fault and all that kind of stuff. And that really made me angry because, it was a lie. So my tweet was bold, lies, lies, lies. The military has not shut down. They're just not getting paid. Played any golf lately? And there was a little stick figure of a golfer. And this thing just suddenly went boom, 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 and I've never seen my Twitter account do that before.
You got blocked for that?
I got blocked for that.
Well, Twitter is his safe place.
Yeah. So the point I wanted to make was that when you're tweeting in that moment and responding to him. You know, so I'm being as impulsive on some level as he is, you know.
Wait, though. I mean, I'm trying to be very serious for the program here. Progressive Voices were very serious. especially on Stephanie Miller's show. But the irony, though, I mean, you know, how does the President of the United States get to block civilians, you know, who are speaking out? And I mean, it's, you're part of your free speech, and I get that that was his private account, but that is also your argument after being turned away by the Navy.
Well, he was taken to court by the ACLU for that very issue.
I was just going
to
bring that up. Yeah. Isn't there a court case somewhere that says that he can't do that? But, you know, onto a more serious question, there's so much conflict between our communities right now. Either this is the LGBTQ diversity group at the Navy that you're trying to support, right? And even this, within the LGBTQ movement, when lesbian, gay service members wanted to fight for the freedom to serve and be out, you know, we were able to come together as a community and fight and mobilize about that. And then when the president had tweeted that transgender service members would be banned from the military, we were able as a community to come together and figure out a way to shut him down, basically. That executive order has not been successful. But there's so much conflicted feelings, because there's a part of us now that, you know, is questioning the support of the administration, the military, the decisions that the higher ups are doing, the leaders. How can anybody support this administration if you're even in the military level? Like, how do we reconcile those feelings? Like, I get so conflicted. We're out in Alameda now, and I see a U.S. Navy ship, and I want to be proud that that's one of our ships, or, you know, whatever we do with that, and just to be proud of that, and then to be proud to be LGBTQ. But there's so much going on that we feel so attacked.
Yeah, you know, this is the result. How you're feeling, the way I see it, and I think a lot of people feel that way, is the result of divisiveness, the result of divisive leadership. The result is coming out in what happened to me. So even if it was an LGBT person themselves, or a diversity person who said, we can't have her, that's what happens when you create divisiveness in a country. We become divided over our flag. When you're liberal, you've told you're not a patriot. And, you know, all this kind of stuff, it just causes such severe division that we are likely to get in. And that's where the bigger fight comes in, maintaining the unity around the issues. And for that, we need good leadership. You know, to be honest, I'm wondering about the LGBT community itself. For example, where is our leadership? Who are our leaders? Who's leading the way here? You know, we're scattered voices. I think the organizations have tended to take over. And when you're organizational, is your first loyalty to your organization and its mission and the fundraising that goes with that, or to the community at large, even though you're dealing with community issues?
Well, I want to add this really quick. I mean, we asked Alicia Garza that when she was here at the club not too long ago. Like, where are the LGBTQ activists and leaders in this movement, in this fight? And I think her answer was really focused on LGBTQ leaders of color who are doing a lot. I mean, hi, Emma Gonzalez, who's a teenager, right, from Parkland High School,
right,
who's leading the movement on anti-gun and violence. But where is the LGBTQ activist community,
right,
such as Chad Griffin, such as the privilege, the upper echelon of LGBTQ activism?
Yeah.
So I kind of wanted to touch on that, because I have the same question. I think that's the reason why we keep inviting LGBTQ thought leaders here, is where do we fit into this movement?
Right.
I think John had a question.
Well, I was just going to say my LGBT leader is Michelle Meow. I mean, this is actually a great topic or subtopic of the whole thing. I mean, we don't have an LGBTQ pope or popette.
Right.
Popess.
Or Messiah.
The more you have, say, any national organization that gets big enough that you could say, oh, okay, well, out of there or from there, the voices will be able to really emphasize. Of course, they have to become blander and blander, or they wouldn't be, you know, national, nationwide things. So it does seem to be, if you're really looking for the voices that are really going to take things on, you are talking more about the local levels, yeah.
Well, let me say one thing. I'd like to distinguish between who happen to be LGBT and taking leadership roles in intersecting and related issues. That, let's put that to one side. To the other side, let's look at purely ourselves as an LGBTQ community who has yet to attain full legislated equality. Now, we have an inherent right to equality. If you challenge the things constitutionally through the courts, we have those rights. They're there. However, with the court clearly swinging, the top court and the lower courts clearly swinging conservative and super right, we are compelled right now as a community like never before to set the benchmark for a civil rights amendment or a full civil rights bill, which is now already introduced into Congress, that full equality bill. When I talk about leadership, I am not seeing anyone out there who is standing or leading our community to stand from the rooftops screaming, where is our full equality bill? Because we are in serious danger right now of these courts taking away what we've accomplished and not giving us what we still need to get. So that's the bottom line for me.
Well, what about LGBTQ politicians such as, you know, our state senator, Scott Wiener? I mean, he has been very vocal about even San Francisco being a sanctuary city, California being a sanctuary state. He's come out in full support of immigrants and the undocumented community and other issues that we feel, especially in the LGBTQ community, that we're also impacted by. Do you think that he could be doing more?
So when I talk about leadership, I'm talking about grassroots. I'm talking about us, all of us on the streets, somebody grabbing that megaphone, 25 of us grabbing megaphones. I'm talking about the organization sitting down at a round table with all their leadership getting together and saying, not separating themselves in terms of the competition that's clearly there between all of them, but actually sitting down and saying, let's think of our community at large, let's form a coalition, because it's the grassroots up that needs to push the politicians. The politicians have all other sorts of considerations. They have mixed communities that are not just us, you know. So, for example, if you bring Scott Wiener into it, this is not his mission to be there as an LGBT activist, even though he contains all of that within what he does. But he's still a politician for everyone. So what I'm thinking about, I'm not looking for a messiah. I'm not looking for one person. I'm looking for a coalition. Let's think about it. Right now, in my email box, when I go home today, I'm going to find 20, 30 organizational letters asking me for money. And they're all going to be talking about the issue of the day, whatever came up today that pushes our buttons. And they all tapped into the same thing. And they're all asking me to sign a petition. And they're all asking me for $10. Okay. And that's going to pay their salaries at the end of the day. That doesn't work for me. I don't respect that. I don't even read those things anymore. I dump them. So here's the thing. We need some genuine work, some genuine activism. We need these people because they have the money, because they're getting salaries, because they're supposedly there on our behalf, to let go of their individual missions, to get around a table together, to call a major press conference, to say these are our rights that are being or at risk right now that we've attained. Let's all together set full equality as our benchmark. We are going to push for this bill. And you know what they're going to say? They're going to say, oh, and we've had this happen all through the last 2 decades. They're going to say, oh, well, it's a Republican Congress and nobody's going to vote and politics, politics, politics. I call BS on that, because if you fail to set the ultimate benchmark in a very hefty fashion, then you're not prepared for when that Congress switches.
You're saying very parallel things to, you know, even what Maxine Waters is saying in terms of, you know, just call it out for what it is. We shouldn't just be soft about this, but if it is a coalition together to impeach the president, that's the message that we need to be saying. On that note, I want to open it up to the audience for any questions for Melanie.
Melanie, I'm here as a protector of civil rights and the rights guaranteed by the first few amendments of our Constitution. I am supportive of the LGBTQ approach, but I'm concerned about the fact that you were shut down in your speech in a clearly protected, forum. And I look forward to a civil rights damages action that will be substantial and, frankly, will teach them where they will learn that is in their pocketbook. Do you think that emphasizing that diminishes the message that you're throwing out, or is it as important a message to get out as any other?
Yeah. From my personal perspective on this, what I do want is accountability. I want some kind of an admission, and I want an apology. And I know that money makes the accountability a sense of achievement or accomplishment. And so if a settlement were to be offered, I would be agreeable on the basis of, I don't want to go too much out of the, you know, talking into the legal part of it, because I would prefer that my lawyer spoke to that. But I, accountability is what I definitely want. But I don't know that if somebody offered me a huge amount of money versus a small amount of money, that just the expression of accountability for me would be okay in these circumstances. For me, it's more about being able to speak out to not silencing people and encouraging people to not allow this administration to intimidate them in any way, shape, or form. And it's kind of interesting because this is a naval base, you know, and he's supposedly commander in chief, and I'm criticizing him. And people tend to take that in a different, can take that in a different direction. And I refuse to do that. I refuse to see it as anything different to being able to stand on a street corner, you know. So I don't see that as being something that should be held in any kind of different realm. But you're right in saying that the optimum thing here is the silencing, you know. So for me, as long as I can speak out and continue to speak out to that First Amendment, my hope is that there would be less of that happening. I think you're making a good point that if they had to pay out some kind of big sum, you know, maybe then they would be less inclined. And then I often wonder if people, you know, when you're in sort of a trickle-down command kind of scenario, if that really, if it's not hurting your own pocketbook or hurting your own job, does that really matter to the people that are involved? And I will be frank with you that I don't want the peripheral people to get into too much trouble around this either. I need to balance that out because I'm grateful for the introduction, and I don't want to hurt anyone at the same time. I know there will be collateral damage.
I want to add that, you know, I think that any department that is being paid for by federal dollars should absolutely adhere to, you know, the Constitution. And there should be a policy in state, you know, somewhere, somehow, in which it could be cited that if you've got programs like this, that everybody's protected by that.
Yeah.
And I think that even the person who responded to you in that fashion should absolutely be fired, because that was, in a lot of ways, a personal opinion about a conflict of interest, that by being critical of the commander-in-chief who is sponsoring this event, well, if the commander-in-chief is sponsoring this event, the commander-in-chief is paid by whom?
Right.
So.
Good point. When I read the wording of that, as a lawyer, I think that whoever wrote that did go to legal and asked for wording. That's my sense of it, because what they allowed themselves to do with that, which was a huge mistake, what I see buried and what I read between the lines is a sense of trying to get out of the contract, to pretend that that contract was never there, cease further discussions. That's trying to say, let's throw this language in and pretend that there was no contract and we just tell her to go away. She'll probably just go away. You know, think about this. If they would have written to me and said, sorry, the event's canceled, I probably wouldn't have bat an eyelid. I'd probably, okay, the event's canceled, blah, blah. You know, end of story.
Right.
But somebody wanted to deal with this, either to stick it to me, which is a little bit there, sticking it to me. And what's also there is, but we don't really have a contract with you. Cease further discussions. They were minimizing it.
But still, I feel very strongly about the fact that federal dollars are being paid for a program that, you know, they too need to adhere to our constitutional rights.
Hi, Melanie. I'm here as a transgender woman who's also a veteran, and I'd like to go back to the initial request for you to speak, and when they specifically said they did not want it to be political, did you take that to mean that you could not discuss the transgender ban? And then B, when you readjusted your content and you were talking about generations of strength, were you going to talk about the history of transgender service in the military? Was that going to come up?
Yes, great question. I had every intention of including a specific line item about transgender people in the military in general, the history. I was going to speak to it from an educational historic perspective. I was going to mention that there's this ban. I was not going to come at it from my own critical perspective. I was going to come at it purely from a factual perspective. And I was going to look, and I was, and part of one of the line items that I presented were heroes in the movement. And I was going to speak to people's stories, even though they're not my stories. I was going to mention the history, the people, the service. And so that was a big part of my talk. But it was going to be given in an educational way without my political commentary. And to me, what politics means is the partisan angle on it. The Democrats this, the Republicans that. I wasn't going to take that road. And I wasn't going to take an activist road of inserting myself in. But what I was going to do was I was definitely going to speak to that and where it is. So I was going to speak historically and to where it is now.
Any other questions? Yes.
Hi, Mom.
Hi, yeah, darling.
I'm here partly as support, and I'm also very closely connected with the LGBTQ community, if you haven't noticed. And I just have one question, but first I'd have to mention that when I was really little, and Mom has always been involved with rallies and politics and all that, she always used to go to these rallies, and I'd see on the news, and I used to get so worried and beg her to, you know, stay at home because I thought something bad would happen to her, that she'd get hurt or killed or shot or something. But she was just determined to pave a way for the diversity for her community, for our community. And she always went. And I was wondering, do you have any reasons for never staying silent? Do you have any inspirations? Not for other people, but for yourself.
Raffaele, that's such a good question, sweetheart. Thank you for that. You know, like I said, I'm very much also an in-the-moment person, as you know. So I never know what's going to come at me and what I'm going to have to face. And just for who I am, I cannot ever imagine being silent about anything. And her asking me that question, no, I can't imagine ever being silent for any reason. I'm not afraid. I don't have any fear. I don't know why. And I know that my children will be well taken care of no matter what. But here's the interesting thing. When I was her age, when I was 13 years of age, and I was in South Africa where women didn't have very many rights in those days, and I walked into a bank with my late mother, who was very much an activist herself for women's rights in South Africa at the time, and she wanted to open a safety deposit box in the bank. And the bank manager said to her, "We need your husband's signature." And my mother went ballistic in the bank. And I remember wanting to find the nearest desk to crawl under. I was so embarrassed because of her confrontational way at that time. And I didn't realize at the time that she was really modeling something for me, that she was saying, wait a minute, why the hell should I have my husband's signature? I'm a grown woman. And she let that bank manager have it. It was the law. It was the regulations. And so I got it at an early age. And I think as a woman, I take on refusing to be silent because I'm so often in situations where I'm mansplained and where I'm approached in a way that I know is different because I'm a woman, and that still goes on. And I don't want to give that example to my daughters. I want my daughters to stand ahead of anything, to never, ever, ever have to think twice, ever, about speaking out about anything, no matter to who, no matter where you are.
Mm. Thank you. And for me too, not just for Raphael, but for Michelle Miao and everyone else who is inspired by all your work. Any other questions by our audience as we start to wrap up?
Thanks, Melanie. Thanks so much for everything that you're doing. You all talked about divisiveness, and this comes up, I think, a lot in conversations we're all having with each other. And, you know, it's so intense, it's paralyzing. And so my question's really about maintaining focus. I'm curious how you do it as a leader, all of you actually. How do you keep your focus on what you need to get done? And then if you have any, words of wisdom or suggestions to those of us just in the community, not leaders, but like in this world, and we see what's going on, you know, do you have any advice for what we could be doing to help move issues forward when everything seems to be an issue? Right? Yeah. How do we actually have impact and not be paralyzed by the divisiveness?
Yeah. I appreciate that question very much. I think because of what's going on right now, I think it's very important to look at what is dividing us and to try and look at the underbelly of that and try and avoid it and try and always maintain a unity. Right now in the LGBT community, as Michelle alluded to earlier, there is some divisiveness going on between our good selves. And and I don't want to get into that now, but that's not okay. We need to find ways around that. That's really important. But when you speak to what we can do, all I can say to that is don't do what you always do, which is simply call your senator, simply call your congressperson, simply write to them, simply go on the street and march. Think what you can do that you've never ever done before. Think of things that go beyond the normal realm of what we do. And we as leaders and our community need to be thinking along those lines. I think that social media has given us a sense of accomplishment that when we've bought into that impulsivity that when we tweet something out or we put something on Facebook or we quickly sign a petition and we just think, well, now we've done our bit. But it's got to be a lot more than that, you know, and that's where leadership comes in. We need to be enhancing those leaders. We need to be propping those leaders up. We need to be finding those leaders. We need to be helping spur them on. You know, I do consider myself somewhat of a leader in the global LGBT world. And when somebody at a level that's not a level of activism or advocacy simply sends me a message, a simple message, and saying to me, Melanie, thanks for what you're doing and have you thought of, I cannot even begin to tell you what that means to me. It means so much to me, and I get ideas and all this kind of thing. So I'm saying, my only answer I can give to that in a short amount of time is for us to think what we can do that we have never done before that's different and really push in that direction.
I also think like being a part of it all. I mean, the other day I was reading an article about someone who, you know, lived behind a vacant building forever and all of a sudden started seeing white unmarked vans pull up and children coming out of the van, and she immediately, without thinking about it, picked up her phone and started recording.
Wow.
And you know, several days recorded the same and started asking questions. And even though, you know, she's scared, she started asking them questions. They even told her, call the police. She calls the police, asks the police, so what's going on? The police don't want to give her the information. So she started sending the videos to the media. And of course, then the media started looking into it, and it turned out that it was a private contractor for the federal government to house the kids that had been separated by their families. and it's on Democracy Now, and then all of a sudden ICE had to respond to it, and I think now the city, and it's in Arizona somewhere, is going to cancel that contract with that company, and it's MVV. And so something as you might think in your head, like it's super small, like, or I know I'm not doing a big thing and I'm just recording this, that led to a cancellation of a contract that have, you know, impacted exactly what we're talking about.
Wow.
And I think that in talking about the family separation stuff, what if we did take an entire map of the United States and found out where these kids are being housed and we showed up there or, you know, something. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying that the pressure has impacted in this way. The cancellation of those contracts means something. Do you have any thoughts?
What's your next tweet to President Trump?
What's that?
What's your next tweet for President Trump?
Oh, wow. Wow, I should try and think of what my last one was. You know, every time he has said something that's bothered me, like calling, I do work with people in Africa, that's the nature of my work. When he came out with that comment about it being S-hole countries, I was so infuriated by that. I tweeted. When he, you know, said that, when he says that the Democrats want open borders, that's a lie. That's not the truth. So and he's lying all the time. I guarantee you in the next hour, he's going to tell a lie when I walk out of here, and I will tweet to that lie and I will call it out. And is it water on a duck's back? I mean, it's like he doesn't care. It's like, what is it? It's like, you know, if somebody called me a liar, it would really bother me. But we're all calling him a liar and it's not bothering him. What world is he in?
Frank, I think you had something to say.
Could we get them?
The quick answer to your question is a narcissist world. But I wanted to follow up on what you said before. Should the LGBTQ community be more involved in democratic politics? And I mean capital D. And I guess for that matter, Republican politics as well. But I mean, is the movement sufficiently engaged in politics?
I think that we have to be very careful as an LGBT community how we engage in politics. And I think big mistakes have been made. And you know I was outspoken on this. Let me give you an example. The Human Rights Campaign, which boasts 3 million members, endorsed Hillary Clinton during the primaries, and it pissed me off. The reason was not because I'm a Bernie or Hillary supporter, but I just felt that it was a divisive move. I felt that the only endorsement should have happened during the general elections, and they should not have taken a side within the realm of the Democratic Party at the time when they stood to alienate a lot of young people who were Bernie supporters and who were LGBT. And I think those people were never able to come back into the Hillary camp. And I actually do put an element of blame on the leadership, so-called leadership, of our own community. A lot of LGBT people are in very high leadership roles in the Democratic Party right now. They're delegates to the Democratic Party, and they are very, very involved. But I think that's important. I think they have taken leadership roles. I think they are in Congress. In statewide positions, in lower level positions, more and more coming up. And I think that's important. And I think we need to get more people involved. And what it really, really, really also boils down to is voting, getting the young people out there to vote, getting everybody out there to vote. And, you know, let's not forget this important thing. The majority of Americans wanted Hillary Clinton as their president as opposed to Donald Trump. Later on, we found out that the Russians were involved in our system. What does that mean to me? That means to me that our electoral system is not working, that our democracy is not working, that it's failed. And we're paying a huge price right now. And I think the best part of what we can all be doing on an intersectional level, all of us, whatever small community, minority community you come from, whether it's sexuality minorities, whether it's of color minorities, whether it's religious minorities, whatever minority you're coming from, we've all got to come together and find a way to figure out what. We know what went wrong, but we're not fixing it. And it cannot be fixed in the normal scheme of things because then it's just business as usual. And business as usual is not working. So there is something dramatic in front of our faces right now. And that's what we've got to face, that beast, and I don't think we're doing it.
I want to add something to this because I feel very passionate about it. I've been taking some time to think about it. I mean, you know, just 2 weeks ago we put on San Francisco Pride, one of the largest Pride celebrations, and there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, the intersection between those who are able to celebrate versus those who are not in our own community. This is my opinion, and my opinion only, but I do think that we need to have strength as far as the LGBTQ community goes to abandon the values of actual LGBTQ leaders that don't stand with the rest of the communities who are being affected. When you have a situation like what's currently happening with this administration taking from the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program to pay for the separation of families or to detain these migrant children, And those two, I mean, think about it. We're taking from I don't even know the proper words to describe how horrible this situation is. But when LGBTQ leaders don't speak up of how wrong this is, and they're ones that we've elected to certain positions or people that we give money to who stand for certain organizations, we need to be ready to denounce them. We need to be ready to, you know, put money into the elected officials, the transgender elected officials who have known what it's like to be oppressed, who've fought through the racist systems, through these all the kinds of these systems, who absolutely understand how these issues are actual LGBTQ issues.
Yeah.
I think that we're talking about the LGBTQ movement as if we have very different or specific issues that's not related to immigration, that's not related to housing and healthcare. And what we need to do, in my opinion, is raise the voices of those who have been affected by these issues, give them the power and the platform and money.
Yeah.
To get them elected, to get them to be leaders of organizations, to get them to be the voices that ask for the $5, the $10 that go to finding services to fight the issues that impact us. Mm-hmm. That's what I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Really good point.
On that
I'm not going to go after that.
No?
Yeah.
No?
That's hard to follow, Michelle.
Well, you know, I've been burnt out from, yes, the Pride celebration, but I also have been, I think your story is so, so important. And why you're talking about it publicly is incredibly important. And the outcome of it is very important, that you tell everybody else what happens, how the Navy responded, because here's the deal. If there were LGBTQ people that were involved in this process of denying you this opportunity, those LGBTQ officials need to have an awakening with themselves. They need to understand what it means to be LGBTQ. And we can't have folks within our own community fall into this file and rank kind of, you know, mentality, I should say. And also, what it does is it stands up and it calls out people who might not even actually realize that this is what they're doing, because that's what happens when you have some dictator who's trying to control everybody's minds. Mm-hmm. And so please come back, or please let us know. We'll be reading your tweets, exactly what the outcome of this whole thing is, and we have to share it with everyone. We cannot oppress our own.
I really appreciate that, Michelle. Thank you so much.
Tell the audience your Twitter handle so people can follow you.
So my Twitter handle is at Melanie, M-E-L-A-N-I-E, Nathan, N-A-T-H-A-N, 1, the number 1. Melanie Nathan 1. And I'm also on Facebook, and I'm Commissioner Mel Nathan on Instagram. And I have a blog called oblogd.blog. And it stands for Oblog D, Oblog Da. Life goes on.
Life does go on, and so does the Twitterverse. Yeah. We're going to wrap up here. But Suzanne, did you have anything, any last?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We kind of skipped over something that the earlier question about should we be more involved in Democratic politics. In 2 weeks, I'm going to fly home to Kentucky, okay? And those are the people that voted for Trump. But when I was growing up in Kentucky, you couldn't be a Republican. When I was a kid, nobody was a Republican before Ronald Reagan. And I do think that the LGBT community has, in order to be more successful, I think this next election cycle, we should be in Ohio, we should be in Michigan, we should be in Kentucky, because this division we're talking about is what allowed this last election. And somehow working class, poor white people think that it's a zero-sum game, that if we as transgender, lesbian, gay people have rights, that they'll have less rights. Huh. And we're not addressing that in the Democratic Party. We've got to, as a group, go to those states and have that discussion with them. We have to say we are about immigration. We are about fair housing. We are about minimum wage increases. We have the same interests, but it's presented to them as an either or, and it's not. And that's the real problem in the Democratic Party. That's why you saw the migration the last cycle to Trump, because those people think that if we are to acquire any rights or any resources, it comes from them, and it doesn't. And so I think it's really important that we as LGBT community start doing that, because right now we're having pride in San Francisco, and I live in the Bay Area, and I don't want to live in Kentucky anymore. But those are the people that we need to convince. The people in the Bay Area already agree with what we're talking about here for the most part, you know, but those people are the people that voted for Trump, and we're not having those discussions. We're here having our discussion about Democratic politics among ourselves, not them.
Great point. Thank you so much, and we'll have Suzanne have the last word. Thank you so much for everyone who joined us here at the Commonwealth Club. We're here every Thursday at noon, but next Tuesday we have a special guest, Katie Sowers, who's the first lesbian NBA – or I'm so not a sports person! NFL. Football. Wrong ball. NFL coach. She'll be here to talk about her experiences and, of course, you know, being part of the NFL, being part of history, and so much good programming. And you can check it all out at Commonwealth Club. I haven't been here for 2 weeks.
.org.
CommonwealthClub.org. I'm going to edit that out. And for everything else, you could head to MichelleMeow.com for more stuff. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us for the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. We're here every Thursday live at the Commonwealth Club, and you can listen to past shows at
CommonwealthClub.org/MMS.